بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Abu Bakr had his terminal illness, and before he died, he collected the Sahaba and told them, "I have made my choice for the one to follow me. I have chosen Umar." And he did that after getting the opinions of the Sahaba. Who unanimously supported the nomination. Some of them commented that Umar was too harsh, perhaps, but Abu Bakr would say he's too harsh because he sees I am too soft. And he asked all the Sahaba and they recommended the regulation, the nomination. And so Abu Bakr, in his illness, called Uthman ibn Affan and dictated him to write something. At the time, only a few people knew how to read and write, and Uthman was one of them. And he dictated, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is what Abu Bakr, the Khalifa, is recommending to the Muslims. And then Abu Bakr lapsed. He fainted. And then Uthman, knowing that he would nominate Abu Bakr, wrote, "I am nominating Umar after me." And then Abu Bakr came back again and asked, "What have you written?" And he said, "I have written, I have nominated Umar after me." And Uthman said, "Allahu Akbar, Alhamdulillah, that you wrote this knowing what I really wanted to dictate." And Umar was assigned the caliphate, and Abu Bakr died on 23rd of August, 634. Umar was 13 years younger than the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. The key of his personality was courage, to be bold. He was so much appreciated by the Prophet even before Umar became a Muslim, and that shows the opinion of the Prophet that people are like metals. The best of them in the Jahiliyyah would be the best of them in Islam when they become Muslims. And it is known that at a time when the Prophet and the Muslims were overwhelmed by the kafirs, that the Prophet asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to support Islam by one of the two Umars. And these two were Umar ibn al-Khattab and Amr ibn al-Hakam, who was another one. And alhamdulillah, Umar ibn al-Khattab accepted Islam and became a Muslim. The story of his Islam is quite intriguing. When in the Jahiliyyah, he was one of the staunchest enemies of Islam. And one day he took his sword and went to kill some Muslims, when a man interrupted him and said, "Umar, where are you going?" And he declared his intention. He said, "Well, before you start killing people, you better look into your own family." And Umar said, "What do you mean?" And the man told him that his own sister, Umar's own sister, had accepted Islam, and her husband accepted Islam. So Umar didn't lose any anger, he even accumulated more anger and just shifted direction to go to his sister's home. And when he was outside, he heard something, some humming, because Fatima and her husband and a few more Muslims were reading the Quran. And so he knocked at the door. They were very frightened. They hid the thing on which the Quran was written, but he stormed his way through And he said, what was this thing I was hearing? And they were subdued by his strong personality, until his sister told him, Omar, we have converted to Islam and we were reciting to the Quran, and it is high time that you review your stand on that. And he hit his sister, causing blood to flow from her mouth, and insisted that he would listen to the thing they were reading. And therefore, his sister asked him, we cannot give it to you because you are a mushrik. Go and bathe yourself and come, which he did. They gave him the page, and he read just a few lines from Surah Taha. Taha ma anzalna alayka al-Qur'an litashqa illa tadhkiratan liman yakhsha, etc., etc. And after reading about four lines, he put it down and asked them, where is Muhammad? And they told him, and he told them, I'm going to declare my Islam. And he went to the Kaaba, where everybody was sitting around, and the kafirs, etc., and at the top of his voice, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammad Rasulullah. And that was a turning point, which proves two things, really. When we speak of the inimitability of the Quran, when we say the Quran was a literary miracle, well, everybody is listening to the Quran and feeling no miracle. Even the Arabs are listening to the Quran. Many of them don't understand what it says, having only a poor command on the Arabic language. Some of them would understand. But to me, the litmus test would be the people living at the time of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, whose capital in life was their strong command on the Arabic language. When you want to know whether a solution in a cup is acidic or alkaline, you wouldn't put your finger to see whether it turns red or blue. You would use an instrument, litmus paper, and you put it in, and the change of color would tell you. And therefore, when I, in the 20th century, know that such a staunch person like Umar ibn al-Khattab, he was not a weakling, he was so strong, and just listened to four lines of the Quran, and so he converted to Islam. This is the test that teaches us that the literary style of the Quran was really a mu'jiza, and using the litmus test of those people, of someone like Omar, it shows us that he saw the mu'jiza and the miracle in the Quran, and he became a Muslim. Later on, he suggested to the Prophet, are we not on the right? Yes, we are. Then we shouldn't pray in hiding. And so the Muslims, for the first time, marched to the Kaaba in two lines, one headed by Umar ibn al-Khattab and the other headed by Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet, who had embraced Islam already, and this was very much to the chagrin of the kafirs, who saw them coming and praying. But because they were awed by such persons as Hamza and Umar in particular, they couldn't attack them. When it was the time of the Hijrah, when the Kafirs plotted to assassinate the Prophet, and when the Prophet had already contacted the people from Medina who were coming on the pilgrimage season, and promised him protection if he went to them, etc., and the Quraysh feared that if the Muslims went to Medina, they might start an Islamic base there which would threaten them. And therefore, they did their best to prevent people from going from Mecca to Medina. And those who had to make the journey did that in secrecy. Except Omar. He went to the Kaaba again and shouted, all people, whoever wants his mother to lose him, or his wife to become a widow, come and meet me at that mountain, because I am going to Medina. And nobody followed him. He witnessed all the progress and the establishment of the Islamic State in Medina under the Prophet. He served Abu Bakr very honestly. And by the way, both Abu Bakr and Umar were very much appreciated by the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, to the extent that the Prophet said, in matters of ijtihad, not on revealed religion, if Abu Bakr and Umar came to the same opinion, I would follow that opinion. So he trusted both people very much. And occasionally he would give advice to the Prophet that the Prophet wouldn't take, and later on the Quran would be revealed supporting the view of Umar. When it was just ijtihad, not revelation, the Prophet was open to say the right or the wrong thing, but on matters of revelation, of course, it would be binding, and he couldn't have made a mistake in giving the religion. And for example, at the Battle of Badr, when the question arose after victory, what to do with the captives? Shall we pursue battle for battle, fighting hard, or shall we accept people who surrender and protect them? Of course, the Islamic teaching is that the captives are in protection of their captivity, and the wounded are in protection of their wounds. But before they became captive, before they became wounded, is it a battle to kill people, or is it a battle to capture people? Abu Bakr said, Prophet of Allah, let us capture them. Anyways, they are our cousins and our relatives, and when the time comes and we are setting them free, we can take a tax for that, and it would enrich our state, the new state in Medina. Umar said, no, we have to tell all the Arabs in the whole peninsula that Islam is strong. And then the Quran was revealed, مَا كَانَ لِنَبِيٍّ أَنْ يَكُونَ لَهُ أَسْرَى حَتَّى يُثْخِنَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. A prophet should really be harsh when going into war, so that all other people would take the message that Islam is strong. Again, Umar is known for the fact that he was really uncomfortable about drinking. Umar used to drink a lot before he became a Muslim. Now that he became a Muslim and the Quran was revealed prohibiting a drink, but in stages, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ, they ask you about drink and gambling. Say, there is benefit to people from them, but there is large sin in them, and the sin is more than the benefits. That was the first stage of prohibiting a drink. The second stage, the Quran said, do not pray while you are drunk, or else you would say things you don't intend to say, or make mistakes in the Quran. But yet Umar was not quite comfortable, and he kept supplicating and praying, please Allah, give us a final word about drinking. Reveal to us the final question about drinking. And then the final banning of drink was revealed by the Quran. إنما الخمر والميسر والأنصاب والأزلام رجس من عمل الشيطان. That drinking and gambling and fortune telling, etc., are rigs, dirt from the doing of the shaitan, so keep away from it. Umar married his daughter Hafsa to the Prophet ﷺ. So the Prophet married Omar's daughter. But also, Omar married a daughter of Ali ibn Abi Talib, the cousin of the Prophet, the complete sister, sibling of Al-Hasan and Al-Hussein. Sometimes as we read superficial history, we are made to think that Omar and Ali were poles apart and that there was hatred and enmity, etc. Yet some deeper reading tells us that the daughter of Omar married the Prophet, the daughter of Ali ibn Abi Talib married Omar ibn al-Khattab. One of the stands of Omar is that when the Prophet was dead, he was so overwhelmed as to say, whoever says Muhammad is dead, I'll kill him. He's not dead. God lifted him up unto himself like he did with Jesus, etc. But until Abu Bakr came and put things aright and read them the Quran, وَمَا مُحَمَّدٌ إِلَّا رَسُولٌ قَدْ خَلَتْ مِنْ قَبْلِهِ الرُّسُلُ. Muhammad is but a messenger preceded by many messengers. Then if he is killed or dies, you turn your backs, and whoever turns his back to Islam, he will not hurt Allah, and Allah will reward those who are thankful for his message. When Abu Bakr wanted to fight the apostasy, the renegades, the Arabs who made themselves prophets and were followed, had a following, or the Arabs who said, well, we're still stay Muslim but we're not paying the zakat, and Abu Bakr said, I'll fight them, seeing that already there was a commitment to fight in the north, the surrogate Arabs of the Roman Empire. And yet Abu Bakr decided both to send the army to the north as well as sending 12 armies to fight the apostates that we saw last time. And by the way, I hope today I wouldn't tax your endurance by showing so many maps and names, etc. I'll try to cut that short. Omar gave Abu Bakr the advice. Abu Bakr, when the Prophet was with us, the revelation came from Allah, and Allah sent the angels to support the Prophet's army. Now there is no revelation, no angels, so take it easy. Don't commit yourself to fight all the Arabs. How about they remain Muslim and don't pay the zakah? Of course, Abu Bakr rebuked him and said, أَجَبَّارٌ فِي الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ خَوَّارٌ فِي الْإِسْلَامِ يَبْنَ الْخَطَّابِ. Would you be a brute before you became a Muslim, and now you are so soft and weak? And Abu Bakr proved, Abu Bakr was always reputed as the softer man, the kinder man, but he insisted that the armies would go. When Omar became a caliph, he already realized that he was reputed for his harshness, and so he made a speech to the people that was the, as they call the speech of the state or something like that, to inaugurate his rule. And he said, I lived with the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. I served him to the best of my ability. I was a sword in his hand. When he raises me or puts me down, I obey. And he died while he was pleased with me. And I served Abu Bakr, and I was a sword in his hand to rise or to put down. And he died while he was pleased with me. And I know that I am now in charge of you. And everybody says Omar is too harsh. I would like to know you to know that this harshness has gone. To those people who are religion-abiding people and good people, I'll put my cheek on the floor for them to step on. But whoever are wrongdoers or try and abuse people or do bad, my harshness would be doubled to them. Omar was quite an awing personality. He was big in his stature. He was described that when he walked, he looked like he was mounted on a horse, so big and so awing to people. One day, in the house of the Prophet, a maid was singing and making that drumming, and Abu Bakr came and she continued, and Omar came and she ran away, and the Prophet told Omar, "Oh Omar, the shaitan fears you." And in one other hadith, the Prophet says, when the shaitan is taking a road and Omar takes the same road, the shaitan will find another road to turn to. Bilal described Omar saying, he's the best of people, but if he becomes angry, then this is a great issue, which was very true. Omar, of course, was very true to the Sharia. I never claimed to be more than he was. He was even modest in his knowledge. And yet history records one of those super physical phenomena manifested by Omar. You know that currently science knows, it is not a myth, that there are other phenomena that can be measured in the lab, like two people thinking the same thing at the same time. Like I look to you and you immediately know what I want to tell you. Like I can imagine things in a distant place and they prove to be true. Yes, they happened, etc. This scientifically you cannot deny, since even modern science is beginning to study these extra physical phenomena. And one time Omar was giving the Jummah khutbah and the Muslim army was fighting at the borders, and there was an ambush for the army, and the only way for the army to be rescued was to climb a mountain and make the mountain shield their backs. And so while Omar was giving the khutbah, suddenly he said, "Ya Sariyatul Jabal, oh Sariya, the mountain." Sariya was the leader of that army, and Sariya heard him and went to the mountain, and the army was saved, and Omar resumed the khutbah again. This is one of those extra physical, extra scientific, ultra scientific phenomena. And pardon? Extrasensory perception. Yes. Omar was very fair and just, especially on himself and his household. He was so obsessed lest he might favor someone near to him, like wife or son, or other members. And it is known that one of his younger sons was caught drinking, and the ruler of the place where that son was applied the punishment of 80 lashes, but he did it in the secrecy, in the privacy of his own home. And Omar didn't like that and brought his son and gave him the 80 lashes in public, so obsessed lest he would have been thought to favor his son. One day Omar was making a speech during which he said, "You, O people, you should listen and obey." When one of the audience interrupted him, "No listening, no obedience, Omar. everyone was surprised. And Omar asked why. The man said, because out of the booty of the battle, you have given us lots of fabric to make clothing. We see you dressed in that fabric, whereas your size is double the one of us. You are such a big man. So you must have given yourself more than you gave everyone else. Upon which Omar shouted, Abdurrahman ibn Omar. He called his own son Abdurrahman. And Abdurrahman stood up and said, I gave my share to my father. So after all, Omar didn't take double the others, but took his son's share. He was so sensitive to his responsibilities about the people. And during the night, he would go walking in the streets of Medina. Perhaps he finds something to command his attention or something to do. In one of those rounds in Medina, he heard a woman in her home reading some poetry. And the poetry was to the effect that, well, I'm here alone, without a sweetheart to be with, just because I'm so keen on keeping my honor and the honor of my husband, and that is why I'm standing this already. And so next day he called on the woman, and he knew that her husband was out in the army, away in the army, and that she missed him. So Omar went and asked his own daughter, Hafsa, the wife of the Prophet, how long can a woman be patient away from her husband? And he started counting, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, when she nodded. And he knew that 6 months is a fair period, and he issued orders that no soldiers should stay away for more than 6 months, and there will be an exchange, etc., etc. Once upon a round of those nightly rounds in Medina also, Omar heard the crying of a baby. And the baby cried again and again, and he knocked at the door and asked the woman, why are the baby crying? He felt responsible for that the baby was crying. And she said, because I am weaning him. And he said, how old is the baby? And she told him the age of the baby. Well, this is such an early age to wean a baby. And she said, what can I do? Because Omar decreed that all Muslims would take a portion of the budget, something like welfare, starting from a certain age. And my son is not that age yet. And so Omar changed that law and ordered that the welfare should go to every Muslim from the time it is born. Again, you know that the story of Omar finding a woman, children crying around her, and there was a fire and a pot, and water was boiling, etc. And he inquired. The woman was trying to cheat the children into thinking that she was cooking something for them, and all that was in the boiling water was stones. And she was just trying to sing to them, etc. And he felt very sad because it was his responsibility, and went and came back with 2 sacks of flour and supplies and food, etc., and sat down and completed the cooking for her. And the woman said, you are better than Omar. And Omar said, thank you, ma'am. Omar took the Islamic justice as long as it went, and not shorter than it should go, The story tells us that one day Umar was in the Medina and he saw a beggar asking people, "Why are you doing that?" "Well, I am old and I am a Jew and I need sadaqah, I need charity." And Umar said, "It would not be becoming when you are young we take the tax from you and neglect you when you are older." And he decreed that all old people, Muslims and non-Muslims, would be beneficiaries of the welfare system. Also in his journey to Palestine, he saw one of those reserves that had existed a long time during the Roman Empire to isolate leprosy patients. Leprosy is a disease that was known to be contagious. It is very disfiguring, etc. And so people used to send the lepers and lock them up in those reserves. And he found that they lacked munitions and supplies and ordered a regular amount of supplies to be sent to them. With all this, one would think that Umar was a very straightforward man who knew good only, etc., etc. But again he says, "I'm not crooked, but the crooked would not deceive me." And so he had his insights in people. When they praised someone to him and said, "Oh, this is a very good man, he doesn't know evil." And his comment was, he would then be more prone to fall into it. And his motto was, "No evil, but don't." No K-N-O-W. No evil, but do not fall into it. He was very particular in his application of the Sharia. And a famous story was when, as a ruler, he received a report on an incident of adultery. And to complete the legal requirements, it was four people. You know, in Islam, zina has two statuses. In religion, it is a grave sin. In the Sharia, which is the law, it should have certain legal requisites in order to be a legal crime, which included four witnesses, unblemished witnesses, known to be good and truthful, who would identify the man, identify the woman, and identify that the sexual act occurred in completion. And so they were unanimous on the details, except that one of them could not identify the woman. So there were four witnesses witnessing to have seen the act of zina. Four of them identified the man. Only three of them identified the woman. And the verdict, 80 lashes to each one of them for blemishing the reputation of a Muslim man and a woman. And that is a little bit of education that I think Muslims need to know. Not all sins in Islam are crimes. A crime is something against the law. And the law is required not even to spy on you. So if you go in your home behind your closed doors and do whatever, drink or adultery or anything, then you have committed a grave sin. And Allah threatens you that your punishment will be doubled on the Day of Judgment and you will stay in that punishment forever. Of course, the Quran adds, except those who have repented and enforce their faith and do righteous deeds, for those Allah will change their sins into charities, and Allah is oft forgiving, most merciful. This is the sin, but the law is something else. You commit a legal crime, when you have fulfilled the legal prerequisites. And since the legal prerequisites did not apply in that case, then the crime will just be dismissed. His justice and fairness that we like to make an example in places where there are racial tensions or color tensions, etc., etc. You know that after the conquest of Egypt, the ruler of Egypt was Amr ibn al-As, and there was a sports day, and on the track, one of the Copts, the Christians of Egypt, won the race against the son of Amr ibn al-As, and the son of Amr went and slapped him and said, "How come you win over the son of the nobility? I'm the son of the ruler," etc., etc. And the man sent word to Omar in Medina, and Omar immediately brought Amr ibn al-As and his son and ordered that the Christian young man would hit the son of Amr. And he did the hitting, and all the time Omar would tell him, "Hit the son of nobility, hit the son of nobility." And after he stopped, he said, "Go and hit the father." And he bared Omar's head. He was completely bald, and said, "Hit the bald head," because without it, that boy wouldn't have said, "I am the son of the nobility." But the boy said, "Well, I hit the one who hit me, and I don't ask for anything further." Such was the meticulousness of Omar, and he said his famous word, "O Amr, since when have you enslaved people while their mothers have borne them free?" One time during the pilgrimage, amongst the pilgrims was a man called Jibilla, who was a Christian king before he became a Muslim. And during the pilgrimage, an Arab stepped on his clothing, the end of his clothing, and so he turned and hit him. And Omar brought him, and brought the man who hit, and asked for retaliation, hit him. But Jibilla, the man, he was a king before, a Christian king, fled and went back to Syria and became a Christian again. After the great conquests at the time of Omar, when Iraq and Persia were conquered, the ruler of Iraq, Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, Sa'd, remember the name, brought a palace, and Omar sent someone to burn the gates of the palace so that everybody can have access to the ruler. And he said, "Rulers need no gates on the residences." One time Abu Ubaidah, the ruler in Syria, sent to Omar that there are some senior Muslims, some very significant Muslims, but who drank alcohol, because they claimed that the drink which is prohibited is the outcome only of dates or grapes. So if you drink anything else, change it into a drink, it wouldn't be haram. This was their justification. Upon which Omar sent to the ruler, Abu Ubaidah, and simply asked him, "Ask them what they are doing is halal or haram." Just a simple question. And then they came to their senses. If they say it is haram, they would be confessing. If they say it is halal, they will be changing an element of religion. Changing an element of religion, and to change one of the essential elements of the religion would be kufr. And at the time, kufr had the punishment of death when a Muslim became kafir. And so they found it safer to say what we do is haram, and got the punishment for drinking there and then. One day, Umar was walking, and he met a man who had killed the brother of Umar al-Khattab in battle. And Umar said to him, "I do not like you." And the man asked, "Would this ever deny me a right or subject me to being wronged?" And Umar said, "Of course not." And the man said, "Then I'm in no need of your love." Umar was so bold and courageous, even in the face of Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam. At the time of Hudaybiyah, the battle when the Prophet wanted to go with the Muslims to make an Umrah, and the Quraysh stopped them, and they signed the agreement that the Muslims would go back this year and come the following year, and the Muslims really were surprised, "How come we accept that?" When the Prophet said, dictated on the pledge, the treaty from Muhammad, the Prophet of God, they said, "No, we don't know that you're the Prophet of God," and said, "Well, from Muhammad ibn Abdullah," etc., etc. The Muslims anguished because it looked like humiliation to the Muslims. And Umar would go to the Prophet, "Are you not the Prophet?" "Yes, I am." "Are we not on the right?" "Yes, I am." "Then how come we accept this humiliation?" So he had his opinion forthcoming even in the face of the Prophet. Of course, Abu Bakr advised him, "Umar, this is the Prophet of Allah, and he knows what he's doing." And it turned up later on that it was a very blessed move on the part of the Prophet. Umar was courageous even in his interpretation of the Sharia, because he knew well deep into his heart that the Sharia is a method to serve a goal. And so he did things in Islam for the first time. For example, it was known in Islam that a man can tell his wife she's divorced, and a month later, if he tells after the coming menstrual period, he would tell her, "You are divorced," and then a month later he would tell her, "You are divorced," and these would add up to 3 times, therefore they cannot be reconciled again. At the time of Umar, a new thing happened, a novelty, that a man would say to his wife, "You are divorced, you are divorced, you are divorced." And it became so easy to people to say the word, the D word, the divorce word. And so Umar said, "Whoever says the 3 together, I will count them as 3. They should be counted as 1. 1 in every menstrual period." But Umar saw that the D word is becoming a popular and easy to use word, and therefore he decreed that if you say them thrice, even in one setting, I'll count them 3 and he will never take her again. And the immediate response was that men came to their senses and wouldn't use the word. Again, the Quran tells us that when the zakat is collected, it should be spent in certain channels. One of them is public relations. You give people whom you want to befriend to buy their friendliness to Islam and not to harass the Muslim caravans, etc. And when it was time, Umar didn't pay them. And everybody was surprised. "Well, Umar, it is mentioned in the Quran, are you negating the Quran? I said, oh no, I am not disobeying the Sharia. But it is just that this ruling does not apply to them. This was decreed when Islam had the need to befriend people. Now Islam is strong, it doesn't need their friendship, and so I'm not paying them that. And this was one of the earliest and most major aspects of ijtihad of Umar. When it was the year of the famine, he stopped to chop off the hands of thieves. And he said, I wouldn't come in this year of extreme hunger and depravity, and I just take it that the punishment does not apply to them. It does not apply to them. Because the punishment necessitates that it has to be a certain amount, not from the public money, not from a relative's money, not locked up money, not while you are able to feed and drink. And if you are hungry and go and steal, then the punishment would cease to be. And so Umar brought this to the attention of people. And a man once brought his two servants to Umar and said, they stole from me. And he said, yes, because we are hungry. And Umar sent them away telling the man, if next time they come stealing you because you are keeping them hungry, then I'll cut your hand, not their hands. One of the things that Umar, the first Umar did, he knew that one of his rulers in Syria married a Christian woman. And so he sent him a letter. By the receipt of this letter, divorce her. And the man was cunning, because it is known that in Islam, a Muslim may marry a Christian woman and a Jewish woman. And so the man sent another letter asking him, is it haram? And Umar answered, no, it is not haram. But if you and your likes would go and find the Roman people, white and beautiful, etc., and marry them, who is going to marry the Muslim woman? And he introduced for the first time the ruling of the narrowing of the lawful, the limiting of the lawful. It is not haram, but it is not the best of the halal. It is halal, but which might be harmful to the general welfare of the nation. And since the time, it is one of the juridical rules at the time. Umar was a strong believer in the integrity and the cohesion of society and responsibility of the government. So he said that if a man in a town died of hunger, then the inhabitants of that town should pay the ransom as if they killed him. So the society and everyone are responsible for everyone. He believed that religion is not rules and regulation and harshness, etc. Once a man asked him, I have a daughter who committed adultery once, and she tried to commit suicide, but she didn't die, she was saved, and now a man is proposing to her, shall we tell him the truth about what happened? And Umar unconditionally said, I wonder, if Allah has covered someone, how come you uncover her? Do not tell him that. To him, religion was here before it was in ritual, etc. And he said, don't look at the prayers of someone or his fasting, etc. But see, when he talks, does he speak the truth? When he is entrusted, does he fulfill the trust? And when he is tempted to do a sin, he would hold himself back. And one day in the mosque, he saw a young man praying, and it was very slow praying, would spend half an hour rukua, half an hour sujood, etc. And after the prayer, he brought him and said, please don't kill our religion for us. So he was aware of how to be mutawakkil ala Allah, and he said, don't the one of you laze from seeking his sustenance while knowing that the sky does not rain silver and gold. He did a very bold thing at the time. We have been discussing the Christmas tree in the first session before many of you came. He ordered that the tree under which the Prophet took the bay'ah, bay'ah al-Ridwan, the pledge of the faithful, he ordered the tree to be cut off so that the Muslims wouldn't make a sacred visitation to it or something supernatural about it, and it was chopped off. I think Maher Hathout wants to tell you something, so I better stop here before pushed aside. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
See the younger brother pushing the older brother.
I don't want to take much of your time. After my older brother took his full hour and full time and finished his lecture, I decided to take a couple more minutes to tell you about something important that happened on the 11th of this month. We could get two senators, who became three senators, to invite us to speak at the Senate about democracy and Islam, and about women's status in Islam. The deal was arranged by MPAC, and the way you do it is that you get the senators to write a letter to invite their colleagues for a breakfast, and they invite us to the breakfast. They invite us to the breakfast, but we pay for the breakfast. And they decide what kind of breakfast and for how many, etc. So, but you are invited anyway. So we were invited, we paid for the breakfast, and we had a very, very fruitful day on Capitol Hill. Surprising those who attended, but how little is known about Islam, and how artificial some of the points of confrontation really are. So, and at the same time, it was attended by some media, particularly the Washington Post, with whom we developed a certain rapport that hopefully will appear in the paper soon. I just wanted to info, and on top of that, there is a commitment from the senator to invite us every year to sponsor such a function. So last year we went to the Congress, this year we went to the Senate, and this is a major and we went to the White House before, but this is such a major breakthrough that I think is very encouraging and very important. Being an opportunist to some extent, these trips and these preparations entail certain expenses. So those of you who are convinced that such an effort should be supplemented, Jimmy will be standing in the back with a box. Please donate to offset some of the expenses, because each time we are about to do something, we say, but there is no budget. You are the budget, and without really any coercion, if you believe in that, please put something in the box. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.